Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2010.
My name is Jonna Ward, and I'm the Executive Director of the Seattle Public Library Foundation. So I'm kind of wearing my library hat tonight. But I want to welcome you here to Central Library, and we are thrilled to be able to kind of kick off this maiden voyage for Craig. We want to be able to have a great program tonight and see a lot of good things. But before we do that, I just wanted to say thank you very much to the Seattle Times. We love the Seattle Times, especially the Foundation, because we have an amazing partnership when it comes to the work, programming such as this, and of course the all-valuable advertising. And generally, if you ask anybody at any of our audiences, oftentimes people have found out about the program because of those ads. But we also have a special glow amongst the Seattle Times folks today, because it's a big day with the winning of a Pulitzer Award, and I hear the everybody's celebrating, so even better. We're glad to have you here. So we are so lucky. We have world-class things happening here in Seattle, and one of the things I want to say about the foundation is we have a world-class foundation, if I can say so myself, that supports this library system. We are so, so fortunate that there are people, large and small, businesses, but mostly individuals, who really step up and allow for the foundation to be able to help the library make possible things like this, summer reading programs, more books on the shelves, all the things that help make the library special. And so we're glad to be able to do that, and some of you may be donors, and I want to thank you for that as well. Karen Maeda Ullman, Elliott Bay Bookstore, another favorite friend of the Foundation and Library, will do our introduction.
So I'm really pleased to be able to be here to introduce Craig Welsh. He's the chief environmental writer for the Seattle Times. His work's been published in many places, including the Smithsonian Magazine, the Washington Post, and Newsweek. He's a past Nieman Foundation Fellow, and he's won many regional and national journalism awards, and has been named to the National Society of Environmental Journalists Outstanding Beat Reporter of the Year. He's here to speak about his new book, Shell Games, Rogues, Smugglers, and the Hunt for Nature's Bounty. And who knew? Right in our own backyard, on our own shores, a resource so valuable that people trade drugs for it, break the law, risk their lives, and even kill for it. It's that staple of the Pike Place Market video clips and dinner tables, the gooey duck. But that's just the beginning of the story, as this is just one of the creatures and plants regularly poached and smuggled for profit. Writer Craig Welsh takes us deep into the story, which involves international smuggling rings, savvy but sometimes unlucky law enforcement, and also the potential collapse of the population of yet another sea creature. He lets us know what's going on out of sight and in many ways out of mind. It's a disturbing and complex story, a cautionary tale, and it's very well told. So Craig's going to speak a little, read a little. He'll take some questions from you. So please join me in welcoming Craig Welsh.
Well, thank you, everybody. It's great to see you all. I hope you don't mind. I have some cheat sheets I'm going to be using. So I want to thank the Library Foundation and Elliott Bay. This is great. I really appreciate being here. And I really want to thank the people I work with at the Seattle Times. This is a really big day for them, and so many of them are here. It's just amazing. I can't thank you enough. Anyway, I want to talk to you a little bit about sort of what it took me to get here. Putting together this book was a bit of a strange ride. I went to prison, went to the Mexican border, went to a strange marine lab, and sort of right on cue, the actual publication of the book was a little strange as well. The book came out last week, and I was thrilled to see that I got a mention in the Wall Street Journal. And as if reminding me not to get a big head. I had a friend from New York send me this photograph. He found my book buried in the stacks in a bookstore in New York City next to a 70-year-old volume of freshwater biology. The next day was also a little strange. I got to be interviewed on an FM drive time radio show in Cleveland. And it didn't really occur to me, though later I learned it occurred to my wife, why they would be interested in a story about gooey duck clams. And that's, of course, because it's an FM drive time radio show. And I think the gentlemen's names are Lanigan and Malone, and, you know, they tell lots of fart jokes and, you know, exactly what you would expect to hear it on the morning on an FM show. So they kept making jokes about the phallic nature of the gooey duck, and me, not thinking, managed to play right into their hands by saying that, yes, there was a period when people were poaching them willy-nilly, and I hear one of the guys talk to his sidekick, he said Willy. Anyway, this is why. So, the Shell Games is the story of a handful of cops, and most of them right here from the Northwest, and a handful of robbers. And these cops are not like the cops you see on the street, but they're all wildlife cops. Most of them work for the State Department of Fish and Wildlife here in Washington. Some of them work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Some of them work for the National Park Service. Their job is policing the theft of nature, and it takes them to some pretty strange places and involves some pretty strange creatures. This particular story grew out of something I did for the Seattle Times a few years ago. I had read a police crime story about a couple of guys being arrested for stealing $3 million worth of gooey duck clams. Seemed like there was no way that was not an interesting story. So I went and talked to the detectives. And after talking to the detectives a few times, I started to realize that, you know, this was not an isolated incident. There were several of these things. In fact, there was an entire subculture of people who were stealing these clams and selling them for profit. And of course, if there are people stealing them, there are also an entire subculture of people who are policing the stealing of these clams. And that just seemed like too weird a world not to spend some time trying to get to know better. So I wrote a story for the newspaper and really enjoyed that. And then shortly after that, I started realizing that there were other things happening in nature too. There were other things being stolen from here in the U.S. and shipped abroad, which is not really the way I think most of us think of wildlife crime. One example was one of the detectives actually told me about a case he had worked in the early 1990s involving sturgeon in the Columbia River. A couple of men had actually stolen several thousand sturgeon, and they'd catch them and gut them and then take the eggs and mix them in a hotel room, and they sold them to a descendant of the Romanovs in New York City, who then shipped them overseas and made millions of dollars pretending they were actually beluga caviar. These guys got caught in what can only be considered one of the most unlucky of ways. They were mixing these in a hotel room, and at the same time, somebody had robbed a bank, and some of the money that had been coated with the dye from the exploding dye pack actually ended up at this hotel. So the FBI ended up at the hotel and said, "Is there anything strange going on in this hotel?" And the hotel clerk said, "Well, there's this strange smell coming out of room 124 you might want to look into." So that's how these guys got busted. Anyway, I also learned about several other types of crime involving nature. And, you know, in each case, the thing that struck me the most was that it was actually all going overseas. And, you know, this is what I typically thought of when I think of wildlife crime. I think about, you know, things in Africa or Asia getting gutted and then sold over here. You know, tiger or elephants and ivory, you know, tigers for their skins, you know, parrots and macaws. I mean, there's a big trade and a big international trade in these kind of animals coming primarily to the U.S. or in some cases places like China. But, you know, in the last 30 years, things had actually started to change a little bit. This is a Gila monster, and it's from the southwest of the U.S., and from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, this was extremely popular. People would steal these things from our lands and sell them overseas. That's a Venus flytrap. Those two were actually, people make millions of dollars taking these things from the wilds of South Carolina and North Carolina and then shipping them to Europe where they're popular with plant enthusiasts. That's a Grand Canyon swallowtail butterfly. This is really popular with insect collectors and particularly in Japan, and I'm actually going to tell you a little bit more about that tonight. This is American ginseng. The ginseng plant is found in all over the Southeast, but it's also in national parks. And it's frequently stolen by the tens of thousands of dollars worth to sell over in China. Which brings us back to the gooey duck. One of the things that struck me is that not everything that is being taken in high volume from the U.S. and sold overseas is actually exotic or rare. Gooey ducks, there are hundreds of millions of them in Puget Sound. But what I also discovered is that this is something that economists had actually been working on for the last 10 years. Black markets around the world and over the course of the last 30 years had just increased dramatically. It's just part of globalization. It's easier to get things from one side of the world that you may not have actually known existed because, you know, we're just a smaller planet now. And the speed of global shipping jet cargo service and the speed of global shipping just made it easier for us to get things from one side of the world to the other side of the world and actually keep it fresh. And that includes stuff from the Pacific Northwest. There are wild grasses like salal. This gentleman right here is actually a Mason County Sheriff's deputy, and it's his full-time job is to actually police the trade in wild greens throughout the Pacific Northwest, or at least in Mason County. And he actually makes about 100 arrests a year. In most cases, the arrests are small. Some cases, they're not so small. This is bear grass. There was a guy in Eugene, Oregon, who actually drove a flat panel truck right up to the forest and hired some people to go out and pick bear grass. And he picked $200,000 worth of bear grass and stole it from these forests in Eugene and then was promptly arrested. Now, one of the bigger cases involves moss. Moss is really popular abroad. There's a $5 million a year legal business gathering moss from the forests in the U.S., including the Pacific Northwest. But in 2004, there was an economist at Oregon State University who basically calculated that if you include moss that's taken illegally off forests, the industry is probably 20 times that large. And just a few years ago, there were a couple of fellows who were arrested in Mount St. Helens National Park after having gathered 150 80-pound bags of moss. This is probably my favorite case. So these are leopard sharks. Leopard sharks are common from basically Oregon to Mexico, but they were so common that in the early 90s, people started gathering them as pets for aquariums. And the California State Legislature was concerned about that. They said, you know, we don't actually study these fish, they're so common, but we have no idea whether or not that's something that we need to worry about. So they basically, in 1994, passed a law that would ban the collection of baby sharks. In 2007, a handful of people were arrested after federal agents figured out that over the course of the previous 12 years, people from San Francisco and LA and San Diego had stolen 60,000 baby leopard sharks. And they were selling them to pet shops and aquariums all over Europe and all over Asia. And one of the folks who was key in this is actually a Mooney Preacher. So anyway, that's a story that I detail in the book. These are baby glass eels in New England. Glass eels are actually a popular delicacy in Japan. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that, you know, because of the way the globe has changed, when you have changes on one side of the globe, it actually affects what happens here. So when Europe and Asia started having problems with their own eel population, people here in New England, for the first time, would actually poach these eels and sell them to Japan and make hundreds of thousands of dollars. All right, so the big question, of course, is, so what? And the answer is, I don't know. It depends. Environmentally, it's really difficult to say this is a bad thing in all cases. These are black bear gallbladders, and pretty much every state in the West has at least once or twice a year somebody poaching a black bear and gathering its gallbladder and sending it to Asia, where it's popular for medicinal purposes. You know, and there are some species where taking them and poaching them in small volumes is not really terribly dangerous. But then there are other cases where it's potentially catastrophic. This is a pinto abalone. This is the only abalone species found in Puget Sound, and it is it's basically racing toward extinction right now. And the main reason that this is heading toward extinction is that in late 80s and early 90s, there was a big market for abalone in Asian restaurants and with folks overseas. And there were a handful of poachers, and particularly one guy, who basically bragged to police that he stole anywhere from 25 to 40,000 of these things while he was legally diving for urchins, sea urchins. And when biologists went down to sort of figure out what the damage was that he'd done, they realized that because abalone need to be close together to mate, all the creatures that were left were so far apart that they weren't mating, and they were just sort of, over time, they were just dying more and more and more. So this is one of the rare cases where you can actually say that poaching by itself is actually driving a species to extinction, which brings us back to this. The reason that I wanted to tell the story through the gooey duck is there are multiple reasons, actually. But the first is that the gooey duck is actually a perfect way to describe the economic and global changes that actually made all this possible. Gooey ducks were not fished commercially. There was no commercial market at all before 1970, which is basically at the same time that the rest of the globe sort of started opening up. The primary market is China. And China, in the last few years, has actually become the world's leading consumer of illicit wildlife. And also, you know, how can you go wrong telling a story with something that looks like that? So for those of you who don't know, gooey ducks can be found on the tide flats, but they weren't really commercially fished until people realized you could get them down deep. And this is how they're fished now. What the guy has in his hand is basically a stinger. It's a water jet that is loosening the sand as it's sort of holding the gooey duck, which is buried in the sand. Divers will take these clams and haul them up on bags, bring them onto a boat, and then put them in carts and ship them overseas. And that's how you do it legally. And then when you do it illegally, you might run into this guy. So this is Detective Ed Voles. And the story in this book starts with Ed Voles. Ed Voles is a fish and wildlife detective, and he started working with the state Fish and Wildlife Department in the 70s. And our story starts in the early 1990s. Ed Voles has just figured out that there are tons of people out stealing gooey duck clams from Puget Sound. He's trying to figure out how many there are, how big this market is, and how dangerous it is. So what he's done is he has actually employed an informant to help him. Well, this informant worked on a boat that mysteriously blew up. And now the guy was seriously injured, not killed. They don't know whether this was actually an accident or something involving his work as an informant. The point is that he worked for a while, and then, you know, he didn't want to have anything to do with the cops anymore. So he's spent a couple of years trying to figure out what's going on with Puget Sound's gooey duck population and the gooey duck poaching, and he no longer has inside eyes inside the black market world. But it turns out there's another fisherman, a guy named Doug Tobin, who has just started fishing, and it's 1995, and he's decided that he's seeing people steal things all around him. And he doesn't like the fact that that's going to affect his ability to actually make money. So he talks to a friend, and this friend says, you know, if you go to the wildlife cops, they might be interested in hearing what you have to say. So I'm going to do a quick reading of the detectives trying to figure out what exactly to do about that. Detective Ed Voles and Kevin Harrington worked from a satellite bureau north of Seattle, a white single-story warehouse tucked behind a Boston Market restaurant. Voles' office was a cheaply carpeted windowless square at the end of a row of pushpin cubicles. In it, he stuffed bookcases with case files and three-ring binders and filled a shelf with treatises like The Textbook of Fish Diseases. Voles constantly redecorated as if to make up for the soulless architecture. He tacked strings of confiscated eagle feathers next to a hanging collection of Bowie knives, or taped wanted posters for a serial poacher alongside a sushi chart. A few months later, it would all come down, and he'd hang photographs of trophy salmon. For a while, he displayed a wall-length map of the western United States, highlighting every place a road-weary cop could find a comfort in. Voles and Harrington huddled inside and hashed out the pros and cons of taking on Doug Tobin as an informant. They couldn't shake their reluctance. The detectives were deep into their investigation of Geoduck trafficking, and they weren't sure they were prepared to start managing someone new. Not after the hand-holding and the scare they'd had with Dave Ferguson. The boat explosion may not have been fatal, but it very easily could have gone the other way. Tobin also sounded like a high-maintenance guy. Voles hadn't technically ever met Doug, but other cops had, and Voles had checked him out. The fisherman's big personality was well-known on the water. The detectives worried Tobin might be difficult to corral. On the other hand, doing nothing wasted an opportunity. Geoduck theft in Puget Sound was exploding, and Voles saw stopping it as more than just a job. Voles had gone from high school to the Army to college and then to work, hiring on as a fish cop in 1976. Early on, he patrolled marine waters at night to make sure fishermen followed the rules. Over time, he came to appreciate Puget Sound's delightful peculiarities. Early in his career, while patrolling his 32-foot bow picker, Voles had caught some commercial salmon fishermen working at night in a closed area. He ordered the boatmen to haul in their gear, and as one pulled up his net, an enormous fishtail broke the surface, snared in the webbing. Voles and the stunned fishermen could see only the narrow muscle linking the creature spotted back to its tail fin, but it stretched the length of Voles' boat. This was no orca or blue whale, but a bafflingly large fish. Voles and the men quarreled over its identity, even after a 200-foot research vessel arrived to pull it free. Before the research crew could hoist the net and untangle the fish, the creature slipped its noose and plunged into the Black Sea. A week later, the mystery fish washed up dead near Seattle, its tail mangled and bloody. It was a whale shark, the world's largest fish, a docile prehistoric-looking filter feeder. Whale sharks can reach 65 feet. Their mouths open wider than doorways and contain 3,000 vestigial teeth. They typically reside in tropical waters around the reefs of the Caribbean or the South Pacific. No one could explain why it had turned up in Puget Sound. For Voles, the incident summoned everything magical about the Sound, the rich mystery of the place and what it once had been. For a century, the Sound's waters had provided a seafood bounty of flaky sablefish, English sole, flounder, and Pacific whiting. Fishermen snared fat chinook with nets, filled mesh cages with shrimp, and hand-jigged for squid on November nights. Perhaps the bonanza should have lasted forever, but by the mid-1990s, it was becoming clear it might not. Scientists had come to view the Sound as a living system influenced by every organism within it. But many of its creatures were in steep decline from overdevelopment, pollution, and simply too much fishing. Puget Sound was undergoing an ecological transformation, and this new order made for unusual encounters. Sea lions, once bound for extinction themselves, had made a comeback after the United States banned shooting them in the 1970s. Now they hung out near a buffet line of shipping locks, chomping the last of a dying run of steelhead. Biologists desperate to break up this snack time took extreme measures to shoo away the pinnipeds. They fired metal pellets from slingshots, shot rubber-tipped arrows from crossbows, and dropped firecrackers that exploded underwater. They even piped in killer whale sounds to make the predators feel like prey. Voles knew cops couldn't save the Sound, but their job description gave them incredible power to fight one problem, illegal fishing. The detectives considered their options. The shellfish inquiry they had started 2 years earlier had now ballooned to unusual proportions. The tips they picked up just kept getting weirder. They heard poachers cut hull sections from their boats to hide air compressors and pretended to troll for fish while divers hunted clams below. Someone marketed stolen geoducks from a Porsche, while another guy used a payphone outside court to arrange one last shellfish buy before jail. Thieves traded clams for Vicodin and swapped them for untaxed cigarettes. By the cops' calculation, dozens of poachers were on the water every week, some smuggling tens of thousands of clams. The cops suspected the value of that probably surpassed several $100,000 a year. Only later would they realize they weren't even close. The detectives could always use better inside information, and Tobin might fill that void. He was smart and creative and drew people to him, and had spent just enough time in prison that smugglers might confide in him. He didn't drink and wasn't known to do drugs, and he would be the rare informant not trying to avoid a jail hitch. Tobin had basically just volunteered. In their office that early July day, Voles and Harrington found a compromise. They would take Tobin on, but they would make him somebody else's problem. The detectives would introduce this new informant to a federal agent. They would take him to one of the nation's best, a federal fish cop with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Special Agent Rich Sievertson, a bureaucratic elbow swinger who spent years working undercover. If Tobin worked for Sievertson, the detectives could avoid some of the headaches. The feds would share the information they got from Tobin, so the detectives would still benefit from his insight. And an old pro would be responsible for keeping the informant in line. Voles and Harrington could stay focused on their own Geoduck investigations, which already managed to dominate their caseloads. It had been that way for so long now that most days they didn't give it much thought. But sometimes it struck them as entirely preposterous. Even with all of Puget Sound's interesting sea life, the snailfishes, the tube snouts, the pricklebacks, and the nudibranchs, this odd long-nosed clam was the thing that people craved, and every poacher with a face mask thought it would make him rich. So next, the feds obviously were very happy to have an informant, and the federal agent decided that his plan for Doug Tobin was to basically treat him as if he were an undercover cop. They would hook him up with wires, and they would actually send him in and have him take on and talk to other folks, and they would try to listen in on the other end and see if they could actually catch criminals that way. For me, the obvious question was, all right, so what is an undercover wildlife operation supposed to look like? So I actually went down to Los Angeles and visited with a guy who many people said was basically the best undercover wildlife operator working in the U.S. today. And his name is Special Agent Ed Newcomer. Special Agent Ed Newcomer began figuring it all out one May afternoon inside a wing of the Los Angeles County Museum of Natural History. The corridors that day were crawling with bug people, entomologists, bug collectors who mounted insects in display boxes, people who kept bugs as pets, bug sellers, bug buyers, jewelers who made necklaces from bug parts, would-be tailors who knit clothing with bug designs, and adults with children who could appreciate a good praying mantis. This was one of the world's largest annual insect shows. Folding tables formed rows of exhibitors' booths, where seated men and women hawked skittering arachnids or laminated insect wing earrings or horn beetles from Borneo. Visitors dickered over prices for pin-mounted scorpions or leeches swimming in Tupperware. 60 vendors attended this fair each year, and most of them knew each other rather well. They bought and sold their wares on an international circuit of fairs or through eBay. Every vendor knew the Butterfly Baron, the guy Special Agent Newcomer had come here to meet. The Butterfly Baron got things few could. The 52-year-old man's name was Yoshi Kojima. Few who knew Yoshi hadn't heard that National Geographic often hired him to scout rainforest jungles for insects. He said he kept a Mexican boy on a $2,000 a month retainer netting butterflies in Honduras. He bragged about bribing border officials so he could sneak endangered insects out of South America. Yoshi usually got what his customers wanted, no matter how difficult or illegal it was. If you wanted a golden birdwing butterfly found only in Indonesia, Yoshi was the guy. If you needed live, fist-sized beetles from Bolivia, Yoshi could get dozens, but they wouldn't come cheap. He once bragged that he had sold 30 beetles in Japan for $10,000 each. He could find rare swallowtail butterflies from East Mojave National Preserve, or sell those swallowtails that we looked at earlier from the Grand Canyon National Park. He snickered at warnings that collecting in those places was a federal crime. Yoshi once told a prospective buyer that 8 people had been arrested for gathering green and yellow swallowtails from China. Then he offered to sell the guy one on the spot. Yoshi always had the rarest material at the best prices. He was thought to rake in several $100,000 a year. He was the world's most notorious butterfly smuggler, and he was raiding the planet of some of its most endangered species. Cops had followed Yoshi for years, but every time they got close, he managed to slip away. He regularly bragged to colleagues about outsmarting investigators. When an agent heard Yoshi would attend the May Bug Fair, the tip worked its way to Special Agent Ed Newcomer. Newcomer had become a wildlife cop in his 30s, later than most. He had been an assistant attorney general for the state of Washington and had turned down an offer to work for the FBI. He wanted to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because Newcomer considered the Wildlife Service an elite posting, one that offered more range and freedom. The FBI fielded nearly 13,000 agents, but Fish and Wildlife employed only a few hundred, and those investigators worked wildlife crimes all over the country. Newcomer worked under a wildlife cop who had made her name chasing alligator poachers in the 70s. She believed in giving agents rope. Even with less than a year on the job, newcomer believed in using it. To catch Yoshi, he knew he would need a fake identity. He knew he would need a name close to his own, one he would answer to if someone called it without warning. He also wanted a surname that sounded a little bit like his own so that he could fudge a signature if he accidentally started signing his own name. This character would need to be vaguely well-educated and free to come and go as he pleased. So newcomer got a haircut and a new name. He became a middle-class suburban guy who sold boating supplies, a boring job that left time for exciting new hobbies, like bug collecting. Newcomer called this fellow Ted Nelson. Newcomer as Ted Nelson had come to the Los Angeles Museum that day without a plan. He went in and looked around for Yoshi. Seeing him, he decided to wing it. He strolled up to Yoshi's booth and started firing off questions, a curious guy just trying to learn about bug collecting. Convincing Yoshi of his sincerity was easy because newcomer's interest in his ignorance was real. He hadn't had time to study up on butterflies, though he'd have plenty of time to do so in coming months. Newcomer could see that Yoshi liked the attention. He pointed out insects and quoted prices, and the two men laughed and nodded. At the end of the day, Yoshi gave Ted Nelson a gift, a box of mounted butterflies to start his collection. Within weeks, the pair became mentor and protege. Over coffee at a Starbucks on Venice Boulevard, Yoshi talked about the time Mexican customs agents caught him with 200 live beetles, and the time a South American official saw a beetle horn poking illegally out of his carry-on. Yoshi told Nelson he sold antiques at auction and had once collected fighting fish. He said that he had run a travel business and had passports in different names. Yoshi explained the extremes to which bug collectors went for their obsession. True insect lovers didn't just catch butterflies, but also gathered larvae, pupae, chrysalises, and cocoons. They grew special plants in their homes and reared their own butterfly specimens. The finest collectors did not want butterflies that had ever flown. Flying could scratch the delicate papery wings. True collectors used caterpillars to produce new specimens before their eyes. The moment butterflies emerged and their wings filled with blood, collectors slipped the fresh specimens in glassine envelopes and refrigerated them. The dying insects would then metabolize their fat to keep warm, and once the butterflies were dead, the collectors could stick them with pins and mount them under glass in display cases. Newcomer filed away each tidbit, not knowing what would prove useful later. He told Yoshi that he reminded him of Indiana Jones. The balding bug collector appreciated the comparison. Yoshi confided that he wanted to take his business in a new direction. He wanted to sell butterflies on eBay, but he feared his written English was too poor. Quote, "I can do so many things, but I could not use eBay." But if Yoshi supplied insects, Ted Nelson could write the descriptions. The two new acquaintances could become business partners. Newcomer suspected his friend just wanted a patsy, wanted somebody he could feed to the cops if he got caught. Ted Nelson, of course, agreed to help. From the beginning, Yoshi made clear his business wasn't always legal. Yoshi warned Nelson to avoid customers who demanded proper documentation. If federal agents contacted him, Nelson was to say his boss kept all the paperwork in Japan. The men agreed to work together, but almost immediately, things went bad. Newcomer went on bug trading websites and found that buyers posted thoughts about one another. It seemed like a good way to him to ingratiate himself to Yoshi. Ted Nelson would post a message vouching for the butterfly man and start taking requests for online orders. Newcomer thought Yoshi would appreciate the initiative. He couldn't have been more wrong. Yoshi instead excoriated his partner. Ted Nelson didn't know what he was doing. Ted Nelson had moved too quickly. Ted Nelson did not properly screen his customers. Ted Nelson was rash. If the feds raided Ted Nelson's home, they'd find Yoshi's name on his computer. Ted Nelson was going to get them both caught. Newcomer had overplayed his hand. After a while, Yoshi returned to Japan. The men stayed in touch, but their relationship grew distant. Yoshi was gone, and the agent had not witnessed a single illegal transaction. Newcomer decided to have Ted Nelson sell his own butterflies on eBay, advertised with digital pictures Yoshi had given him. He hoped to actually get some kind of attention from Yoshi. At the opening of each auction, Newcomer would assign other federal agents to post the highest bid. He held dozens of online auctions, hoping to elicit any kind of response. He did not expect the reaction he got. Yoshi was livid once again. Now he saw Ted Nelson as competition, and Yoshi started campaigning against him. Whenever Ted Nelson posted a butterfly for sale, Yoshi posted the same species on another website. Sometimes Yoshi would even add a jab. "Shame on you, Ted Nelson," he wrote. "You're using my photos without permission." Yoshi advertised his goods as, quote, "cheaper than eBay auction and Ted Nelson." Newcomer's aggressive tactics weren't working. More than a year after their first meeting, Newcomer had actually turned Yoshi against him. One day, newcomer took a call from the California Department of Fish and Game in San Diego. A man ranting about butterfly smugglers, one smuggler in particular, had left a recorded message on the agency's tip line. It was Yoshi, calling anonymously. He was turning Ted Nelson in. Newcomer knew his case was in trouble, but insisted on trying to salvage something. He asked another agent to pose as a collector and purchase butterflies from Yoshi online. In a moment of weakness, the careful dealer let down his guard and sold this stranger three Bhutan Glory butterflies. They were sold without permits. A package of butterflies arrived from Yoshi. They were smuggled, misdeclared, and lacking proper paperwork. The agents had finally caught Yoshi committing crimes. But the crimes were a joke, and newcomer knew it. Rather than a conspiracy to smuggle thousands of imperiled animals, the agent, after more than a year's work, had caught the butterfly kingpin trafficking in $137 worth of insects. It was like nailing Pablo Escobar for snorting a line of coke. No U.S. attorney would touch a case so small. Worse, Yoshi had stopped returning Ted Nelson's emails or posting on websites. Newcomer ran several more eBay auctions, but the butterfly king didn't surface again. Special Agent Ed Newcomer had torpedoed his own case. The agent figured he'd never see Yoshi again, but their relationship had actually only just begun. So, back to the main story. After Doug Tobin, the informant, spends basically a year working undercover with the cops here in Puget Sound trying to catch geoduck poachers. And they've got a long list of bad guys, about 40 people that they want to try and arrest. They're completely thrilled with Tobin. He's getting them in with the bad guys. They're hooking up and listening to secret conversations. And then one day in July of 1997, Tobin gets a call from somebody saying, he gets a call from a broker in Las Vegas named Nichols DeCorville. Nichols DeCorville is one of the guys that they've been trying to stop. And Nichols DeCorville is having trouble with a rival. And he decides that the only answer is to blow the guy up in his truck. The rival's name is Casey Baker, and he's actually not committing any crimes. He's just trying to make ends meet. So he's been offering divers good money to actually sell their clams solely to him. Nichols DeCorville decides that he wants to do something about that. Well, Tobin hears this, and of course, he calls the cops and says, "You're never going to believe what I just hear." So I'm going to read to you a little bit about the cops' reaction when they find out. Special Agent Rich Sievertson wouldn't have blood spilled over clams on his watch. But to stop it, he needed to understand every nuance of the exchange between Tobin and DeCorville. Then the federal agents and detectives could map some sort of intervention. Tobin arrived 20 minutes late and repeated what the Las Vegas broker had told him. Ravenous customers were buying up Casey Baker's clams. Desperate for a line on new supplies of shellfish, Baker had offered Indian divers an extra $2 per pound to sell to him. It was 40% more than DeCorville normally paid, and divers flocked to Baker. DeCorville refused to match his competitor's price. Instead, DeCorville had settled on another plan. He would hire a 300-pound hitman from Los Angeles to blow up Baker in his truck. DeCorville had asked Tobin to meet the guy and point out Baker. Special Agent Rich Sievertson needed more. That night, he wired electronic surveillance equipment to a nearby payphone and told Doug Tobin to call DeCorville back. Sievertson would coach him through the call. Without prompting, DeCorville started railing about Baker. Earlier that day, Baker had purchased nearly all the available geoducks in South Sound. The few that remained were more expensive than DeCorville said he could afford. Quote, "That's not right," DeCorville barked into the phone. "I'm short yesterday because Baker got them all. Now I'm short again today." Worse, he had big orders for Friday and Saturday, and his divers weren't working. Quote, "I'm screwed for the week," he said. I'm dying, man." Well, Doug Tobin says, "He's hurting me too. I'm taking the shorts just as bad as you are." Tobin's nimbleness never ceased to amaze Agent Sievertson, but this time a great deal was riding on his performance, including Casey Baker's life and Sievertson's career. The veteran agent could not take chances. He needed DeCorville to be explicit, but Tobin couldn't plant ideas in his head, nor could he push the geoduck broker where he didn't want to go. Sievertson was getting antsy, and DeCorville had only briefly mentioned, quote, "the truck situation." Finally, Tobin snapped in either real or calculated frustration. He told DeCorville to spit it out. What did he want? Quote, "I don't want to do him in," DeCorville blurted out. "I don't want to do that. I just want to hurt him." Sievertson felt some relief, but only for a moment. Just about anything could still happen. "So, you know, how do we do that?" Tobin asked. "Well, I can take care of the truck," DeCorville said. What the hell did that mean? Tobin urged DeCorville to explain. DeCorville said he was at his girlfriend's house. He couldn't get into it right now. He had to be discreet. Quote, If that truck goes, if that truck breaks down, then he's hurting, DeCorville said. And he's, you know, he's talked to. He's hurting more. You know what I mean? I'm trying to, Tobin said. Do you mean if he's talked to, you know, in a physical way? Was DeCorville suggesting they could blow up the truck without Baker in it and then send the guy to smack him around? Yeah, physical. That's what I mean. So this is what the 300-pound guy is for. Yeah, DeCorville said. The hitman. He's a sheriff, retired. He's a retired sheriff, Tobin said. That's great. Yeah, the boys use him all the time, DeCorville said. Well, it sounds like you've mellowed since this morning here. The scenario, while serious, was not as straightforward as Tobin had described to the agents. Was DeCorville having second thoughts? DeCorville changed the subject. They talked about Tobin's family briefly and chatted about DeCorville perhaps going to Canada to get his gooey ducks. Then DeCorville said, quote, I'd like to see an arm or a leg, you know? You know what I'm talking about? This time Tobin did. I understand. An arm or a leg will work. So, what can I do to help you? I'm trying to relieve the strain on you. You know why? Because I need you to buy gooey ducks. So the less strain you have on you, the longer you're going to live. That's a native thing, Nick. The man's name is Rick, DeCorville blurted out. About 300 pounds, blonde hair. All I want you to do is point him in the right direction. I don't want the wrong guy hurt. Once Tobin was off the phone, the agents talked about this. Rick. Shit. No last name. They still didn't know anywhere near enough. The agents weren't clear on just what DeCorville wanted. They couldn't be sure he wouldn't try to kill Baker. It was possible DeCorville just didn't want to tell Tobin, so they had to cook up an excuse for their informant to call back and ask for some sort of clarity. This time, DeCorville didn't equivocate. He had contacted his helpers that very morning. Casey Baker, he said, quote, had to have the shit beat out of him, plain and simple. Quote, they're going to call me back tonight with the cost, and they're going to make the arrangements. They're going to use one guy from up here and another guy from L.A. Wow, Tobin said. They're that good, huh? Let me tell you something in confidence, DeCorville said. I used to do things for the mob. These are mob guys, okay? And this is a retired sheriff who used to work for the mob while he was a sheriff. A 300-pounder. These guys are pros. He trained Robert De Niro in a movie, you know, telling him how to be tough. He's expensive, but see, I got a friend. We have mutual friends. Tobin asked to hear more. This guy in Seattle, is he an ex-cop too, Tobin said? No, DeCorville said. He's part of the mafia. So I don't know him, right? No, he's a mafia guy. Tobin told DeCorville to be sure and let him know when the deed went down. Tobin told the broker he wanted to be 200 miles out to sea with friends when it happened. He wanted to be free from scrutiny. Quote, I feel, you know, pretty safe saying that you're my friend, Tobin said. You've been there, and I hope I've been there for you. Yeah, you've been there for me, DeCorville said. I treat you like a brother. I treat you just like I do my own brother. So we've got a common interest here, Tobin said. And the sooner this guy quits gouging into my pocket and yours, then the better our relationship's going to be. I mean, it's just a business thing. DeCorville said he didn't know precisely when things would happen, but he had been told the attack would take place in fewer than 10 days. These guys don't miss, DeCorville said. They do precisely what you tell them. They're professionals, and they'll disappear. These guys are pros. They don't screw around. Well, look, Tobin said. There's no way this is going to come back on you, is it? I don't see how, DeCorville said. You're the only link, and I trust you. That's it. Thank you. So thank you all for coming, and if anybody has any questions, great. If not, I'll sign some books and let everybody go home. I would love to write another book, but I don't know that I have the energy. This was a little harder than I thought it would be. And yeah, I have no idea, and I wasn't even prepared to think about that yet. Yes. You know, I did not write as I went, and if I had to do over again, I would. I spent a lot of time trying to gather documents, and you know that's the only way to put together a story like this. I'm actually sort of retelling scenes that I didn't witness. That's the beauty of dealing with police stories, because you know they have to document so much. You can actually, I mean, there are a couple scenes where people are being interrogated, and the police have actually written in the reports that they can see smoke from the guy's cigarette hovering in a little haze above his head. And you know, you don't get that anywhere. But I would say if I had to do it over again, I would start writing a whole lot sooner. I did all the reporting first and then started writing and didn't leave myself anywhere near as much time as I wish I had. Yeah, Linda. So she wanted to know what was the biggest surprise. You know, I have to say that, I mean, I like things that are strange. The thing that I liked the most was the variety. I mean, everywhere I went, I mean, there was somebody who was, you know, working as an undercover informant with gooey ducks, or somebody who was actually, I mean, the end of the butterfly story is actually stranger than the beginning. And I just didn't have time to read it all to you. You know, the the story of the Mooney preacher in San Francisco stealing the leopard sharks is just insane. And I mean, I just loved every time I turned around, there was something new. And I mean, I could have written an entire another volume. I mean, it was great. There's no lacking material. Yes. You know, there were two gentlemen arrested about 8 months ago for stealing something on the order of $50,000 with the Guidex. And I know that there's actually a case going on right now. I mean, it's pretty common. You know, there's just so much money to be made. It's sort of hard for them not to have it happen. So, yeah. Well, I actually have a short section in the beginning of the book that sort of describes the scope of wildlife trafficking inside the U.S. And the first time I wrote that, it was 7,000 words. And when it appears in the book, it's about 700. And, you know, it's just, I bounce around so much already that I couldn't afford to keep it in there. But, I mean, I love it. The material was just amazing. You know, the descriptions of the lengths that people go to get wildlife into or out of the country is pretty crazy. Mike. You know, actually, it's pretty good. I mean, I got a really cool email from one of the cops I went to see who's in South Carolina. And he said, "You didn't make us look good in all cases, but I'm surprised at how accurate it was." And I was like, you know, that's all I can ask for. And I was really thrilled to hear that. So, you know, so far so good. And the cops here in Puget Sound, you know, I mean, they're chasing bad guys and for the most part catching them. So, you know, they come off looking pretty good. Yes. No. No. And on both counts. Doug Tobin is still in prison, and I have no idea what he thinks of the book. And I'm not really going to go seek it out. I'm sorry? He was sentenced to 14 years, so several more years. Yeah. No. But I do actually have a photograph at home that I keep of the 300-pound hitman, because the 300-pound hitman actually carries a teddy bear because he's afraid of flying. And the cops took a photograph of him. When the cops told me that, I wouldn't have believed it, but they actually took a photograph of him holding a teddy bear. So I kept that. Anyway, well, thank you all very much. I'm really thrilled that you guys came. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.